This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Shut up and sit down.
All right, everybody, we've got another great episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast for you. As we get further into the season here, we're going to start talking a little bit more about tactics and going through some hunts and talking to some guests about different types of tactics, different terrain, and things that we think will help us as well as the listener, to maybe have their most successful season yet. That's what we're all looking forward to. So, this week we're talking to Tim Clark. He runs the Michigan Saddle Hunters page on Facebook, and he set his goals to kill a commemorative Bucks of Michigan buck every year, or just shoot some does. So his goal is 100-inch deer or better. And if you've been following along with the Hunting Public, Hunting Beast, Tethered, Public Land Challenge, maybe some of you guys that aren't in Michigan are getting to see kind of what it's like to hunt in Michigan and to see how difficult that may be to kill a 100-inch deer every year in Michigan. So Tim's had a couple really cool hunts when I was talking to him a while back at the Michigan BHA rendezvous. He was telling me how he had adapted, to other types of pressure from other hunters. So not only to the deer, but also to the hunters, and how he was using that kind of to his advantage. And then one of the stories that he's got is probably one of the best days in the woods ever. It's just a really, really cool story, and it stems from trying to get away from people and adapting on the fly during the season. So I just want to get him on here and talk about that, and maybe it can help some of you to kind of think outside the box, and that's kind of what we're trying to do here. So great episode, fun conversation, and like I say, one of the best hunting stories probably, that I've ever heard. And, I get to hear all of Frank's stories. So, I mean, it's a definite must listen. But let's get some of the stuff out of the way right now. Just thanks to, our Patreons. Our latest Patreon is actually one of our former guests, Mark Slagle. So thanks, Mark, for, putting up some money, every month to help us out and continue doing what we're doing. Every little bit helps, and we certainly appreciate that. I've got your koozies and stickers in the mail, and those are going out. They should be reaching you anytime here now. And so we send out, a little care package to each one of our Patreons, just to say thank you and really do appreciate it, as well as we do quarterly giveaways. This quarter, you know, by the end of the year, we're going to be giving away a saddle or a gift card to either Tethered or Trophy Line. You know, one of the saddle companies, that's what it's going to be for this last quarter of 2019. So if you're interested in that, go over and check our Patreon page account out. It's patreon.com/Bowhunter Chronicles Podcast or the bowhunterchroniclespodcast.com. There's a link to our Patreon right on there. So, you know, go ahead and check that out. If not, you want some koozies, we've got some on the website. Just ordered some more shirts. So, you know, people have been asking when is there going to be more shirts in. Those are on order, so we'll have those up pretty soon. But if you're not into all that and you just like listening to the show, like listening to Frank, like hearing a different perspective, you know, please just hit that 5-star rating button on whatever platform you're listening. That really helps us. And if you love what we're doing, if you hate what we're doing, either way, you know, please write us a review. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, things that we can do better, because that's the only feedback we get is, you know, how many people see the show and those types of reviews. So those things help us out, you know, more than you guys understand. So if you haven't done that, please do that. Tell a friend, share with them your favorite episode, and, you know, just get us out there in front of as many people as you can, because that really helps us out and, you know, helps us to know, you know, that we're being well received. So every little bit helps. We really certainly appreciate it. And I think you're really going to like this episode. Tim's got some great stories. So without further ado, here we go. Enjoy the episode. Thanks for listening. Hey, everybody. Another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles for you. Adam and Frank here. John is out on his yearly anniversary trip in October. Who gets married in October? And that's a Bowhunter, Bowhunting podcast guy. That's
on the Leaf Tour.
Yeah. Yeah. Got to do the color tour. So today we've got another fellow Michigan hunter. You might remember him from the podcast that we did about raising your kids outside. Tim Clark is back on the podcast here to talk to us today. We're going to talk a little bit about tactics, and you know, Tim kind of has some outside of the box thinking. He's got lofty goals hunting the state of Michigan, and I think a lot of our listeners can benefit from some of the things that you know, Tim's got to say and some of his types of ideas and in the way that he kind of approaches his hunting style. So, how you doing tonight, Tim?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Tired, long day, you know, hunting, killing, recovering, cutting, all that sort of thing. But that's another podcast for another day.
Man, it's the most wonderful time of the year.
Right. And, you know, being this early in the year, now it gets into the fun stuff, because now I'm like, all right, the pressure's off. Everything is good. A lot of days left. Best time still coming up, so.
Yep, I actually filled a doe tag on Friday evening, a public land doe tag, and that felt really good, just like you said, take the pressure off, get that first one under the belt for the year, and now it's easy to, you know, take my time into the rest of it. I get my kids out with me quite a bit, so I've been making sure I do kind of a one-on-one. You know, I'll get out one day by myself and then a day with them, and it sure is nice when I fill my own tag a little bit earlier.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, Frank, John's on vacation, but his buddy Ernie, myself, we're on the board. Frank had his opportunity.
Yeah.
And Mr. Stick got in the way.
Well, Mr. Wim.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, Tim, so for guys that aren't familiar with, you know, maybe didn't hear the last podcast or anything like that, give us a little bit about the backstory on yourself a little bit. Introduce yourself to the listener.
Sure. Yeah, so my name's Tim Clark. I was pretty much brought up without, you know, my dad never hunted or anything, but he did have some friends that did. And by the time I was about 11 or 12 years old, he had been asked to go to deer camp with a couple of his buddies. And so he asked if I wanted to go, if my brothers wanted to go. And I shot my hand up and said, yeah, I'd love to go. And boy, after that, I was hooked. Dad never killed a deer while we were at deer camp there. But for those first 2 years, I couldn't shoot. So I just sat in a box blind with Dad, didn't know anything different. But every time we'd see deer, it was exciting. And by the time I was 14, I got to sit by myself, and I pulled the trigger on my first Michigan buck that afternoon. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'd been sitting in this box blind just watching just tons and tons and tons of does come pouring out of the swamp, this great big parrot pile that we had, and finally a spike came out, so I shot it. You know, so that was my first one, and pretty much ever since then, it's just been a steady progression into actually becoming a hunter, and more than just sitting in a blind a couple days a year. But I did do that for a few years, and then by the time I was 17, I had my first successful bow hunt. I picked my first bow up when I was 15, and had a couple years of missing everything that came within 40 yards of me, and finally stuck one when I was 17, and since then, I haven't had a year that I haven't killed one with a bow. So I've just, you know, progressively gotten more and more successful. But through the years, you know, I went through the whole kill any buck that comes my way to eventually it was, right around 2008, I believe. I had set my sights, actually it was a little bit earlier than that, I had set my sights on not killing any small buck. I wanted to put him in the record book, and that sort of stemmed from a friendship that I have, my hunting partner, John. He and I, we've been hunting together, you know, since probably 2005 or so, and he's a scorer for commemorative bucks in Michigan, so we get to have our hands on a lot of antlers. And I've helped him score a whole lot of different bucks and stuff. And I just think it's really cool. I think that's kind of a fun goal to set. And 100 inches with a bow, I don't think is an unachievable goal. It just takes some work, right? You know, and it's not going to happen everywhere or for everybody, you know. But I've kind of set my goals on that. So that's where I go. And it means I don't kill bucks every year, you know, for the most part. But I do have, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 of them on the wall that are, you know, 100-inch bucks or better. I think 125 is my biggest one here in the state. I've got a couple of those, but just shy of Pope and Young, actually, by the time they dry. But, yeah, you know, they're not giants. They're big for Michigan. But one of the things that has kind of stood out to me is I hunt for the experience and learning things a whole lot more than the antlers. I just kind of set my goals on those because that's typically a 2.5 or 3.5 year old deer that I'm able to find. Every once in a while, I'll find one that's bigger, but some of the most memorable ones are actually, they're not the biggest antlers. They're the biggest bodies. I don't know how many you've shot big body deer, you know, but when you get over that 200-pound range dressed out, it's just, it's piles of fun. You see them, they're like a whole different animal. And so I focused a lot on trying to get, you know, the bigger, older, best deer that I can find on the properties that I'm able to hunt. It's been a pretty fun journey for me. And now I'm to the point where my my financial situation doesn't allow me to both raise kids and pay for hunting leases and the thought of buying property that I could groom or anything doesn't really cross my radar anymore. So it's public land stuff. And we've taken some trips out of state and come back empty handed, you know, passing up smaller ones and stuff. But it's a fun game that we play. You know, I always find bucks, just sometimes they're not the caliber I'm wanting to kill, So.
And so with the switching over to public land, how has that impacted your thought process or whatever? You know, I've said it a bunch of times on this podcast for sure. But I always used to thought, I always thought that public land was like in somewhat less than, or like, you know, for, you know.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. I've heard you say that before. And yeah, I felt the exact same way. Like, that's a last resort. Why would I want to go put myself through all that hassle, you know, all the pressure that you find on public land and running into everybody else and blah, 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 all that stuff. But to me, now I've gotten to the point where, shoot, when I run into people on public land, you know, I go and introduce myself and say hello, you know, and we're doing the same thing. We're out there for the same purpose. So no sense being upset that somebody else is using property that belongs to them as much as me. But a lot of the time, what I really like about it the most is that there's always opportunity. You know, in Michigan, we've got so much public land. We've got, you know, 7 million acres plus. That's a whole lot of public land that we can explore. Now, granted, it's all topped up all across the state, but, you know, it's been said on countless other podcasts I've listened to and all that, like, hey, if you don't like it here, just drive down the road a little ways. There's another piece you can find, you know? And that's the truth. And it's pretty cool. Like, for example, tonight, you know, I took my son, he's 9. He really wanted to get out and have a chance to kill a deer. And there's a property that I had found. I actually killed a doe off of it on Friday. And there was a bunch of turkeys back there and a whole lot of deer. And boy, he's still hunting on that mentored youth license. So he's got every tag available in his pocket. And he's like, can we go down there? You know, it's public land. And so we go out there to hunt. And the thing that crossed my mind as we were getting set up in there was, you know, you just never know what's going to happen. You know, you're hunting a big tract of public property. Even if there are other people out there, they could be bumping stuff your way. You could be sitting in a spot where anything could come out of the swamp. You really don't know. You know, we've got a family property here that's the exact opposite of that. That's like, you know, maybe once a year somebody spots a decent buck in the area. And I could do that. I could hunt behind the house, but there's just not a lot of deer, and you know it when you live on it. You know that there's just not a lot of opportunity there. It's kind of that. There's a lot of, it's like a wishful thinking or hope, whatever you want to call it. You know, when you sit out there on a piece of property that you really don't know, you're just checking it out. Boy, anything could happen. It makes the whole hunt pretty exciting. So,
yeah.
I like that. I think that aspect of public land really does, it makes me feel like, hey, you know, anybody can do this, and if this one ends up being a bust and we don't see anything that's worth pulling the trigger on or releasing the string on, we'll move on to another one. You know, there's plenty of it to bounce between. So as long as it's relatively safe, you know, then I'm all about it. Now, granted, I do avoid those properties that are smaller and heavy pressure during the gun season with the kids and stuff, but bow hunting, shoot, it's a great thing.
Yeah, you know, for me, it's just more of, when you said that you like that challenge of finding the deer and kind of, you know, having that,
yeah,
that sort of thing, until, you know, we started all this, you know, which really changed my whole perspective is talking to other people. It's like, you know, the boundaries, right? So if you're, mm-hmm, hunting even a 40 acre piece of property and there's a couple of good spots to hunt and everything's happening just on the other side of the fence in your neighbor's property, well, you can't just walk over there and, you know, or you can't just go find another better spot on your 40 acre piece. You know, you're limited to that one stand or that, you know, those couple locations, and now you're just hoping that that deer meanders over. Whereas when you get these big giant tracts of public land, if you're sitting somewhere and you see something happen 200 yards away, 100 yards away, you can just get down and move over there, and you know, you don't have to worry about it. And if, like you said, if there's guys or anything like that, you can just go, you know, find another spot relatively easily. Yeah. But if you put all your eggs in one basket in a public or a private land setting, and you bring people with you or anything like that, it narrows it down so much. And I never thought about it like that, you know, it being an asset rather than a, you know, a handicap, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So,
you know, and I'm not to downplay, you know, private land hunting. There's definitely good stuff to be had there too. But I found that on the family property here that I'm able to hunt, the amount of work that it would take to make it something that was going to give me more than just a spot or two to hunt, that's a whole lot of throwing all your eggs in one basket. So I really like the idea of being able to move around and get away from pressure if you need to, or find the deer and move on them. And it's been a really fun progression for me. We've gotten to the point where, you know, I'm spending hours just every night for, you know, a long time just looking at Onyx, looking at my maps and digging through areas, you know, making predictions of where I think things would be, you know. And you start looking at transition lines around swamps and, you know, anything and everything that you can find. And now I'm not going to regurgitate a whole bunch of information that you can hear on, you know, any other tactical podcast or, you know, reading on the Hunting Beast or different forums online and stuff. There's a lot of, you know, kind of that same thought process. Some of the stuff that has made the most sense to me is when I find an area on a map, I'll go for a drive, usually by myself, and I'll go just from the road, look around and drive the section and find whether it matches what the map looks like to me in my head. And once I do that, I'm starting to find, okay, if it's got crop fields close to it, I'll start glassing the fields and seeing if there's big deer, if there's anything that's worth chasing in there. And if there's not, then I just move on to the next one. That's kind of like my starting point in the summertime. And, you know, there's the whole post-season scouting, you know, wintertime, running around through the woods. I do a little bit of that. I'd like to do more, but I just never have the time. And, you know, for me, I just can't sacrifice every single Saturday to, you know, to go stomp around through the swamps. So I usually get, you know, a couple, you know, two or three good days that I can do that, and I'll key on spots that I think they're the best chance ones. But then summertime, I'm following up on what I've been looking at on the map, trying to find deer. And then part of what you're asking on the strategies and stuff of how I get into them. You know, most of the time when I find deer that are in a field, they pretty much know they're being watched before too long, because if they're in a field and you can see them from the road, I'm not the only guy looking at them. So then I just have to get creative in how I'm going to approach, you know, getting into their habitat. And so it's, you know, sort of property dependent, right? You know, you're not going to do the same thing on property A as you're going to do on property B, but every once in a while you can get the cards to fall in your direction if you kind of know a little bit more than just, hey, there's a deer in the area. So, for instance, you know, there's one property I really like to hunt. Been a couple years of running around out there, and it's one of those properties that's sort of like that typical, the deer can easily see right to the access parking spot. And so I'll you know, looking at that, every time I'd pull into that access lot, deer out in the field would see, you know, the deer that are, you know, the deer that are in the field are going to watch you. Sometimes they'd put up with it, but they know that that's just, that's a point of entrance. And the best hunting is within eyesight of there. I mean, it's not very far. If you can get to it without spooking everything out of it. So that's kind of the tricky thing. So I spend some time in the summertime, you know, trying to find those spots, the ways that you can get into things that you wouldn't normally just walk a straight line to. So, you know, kind of finding the back doors to places. And sometimes that means putting in either a long walk or a boat ride or, you know, getting up a couple hours earlier. Sometimes it's, the spot's only going to work if it's raining or if the wind's blowing a certain direction. So I sort of just put all that information together and go, okay, I know I can't hunt this spot if I've got any sort of north wind. And so I'm always paying attention to that's where I want to be if there's any sort of south wind, and I'm going to access it in this direction or whatever. And those are things that, you know, I think a lot of guys either don't think about or think about in just pieces, you know. I think when you're trying to be successful on a deer, you kind of got to look at it from a holistic standpoint. Like, it's not just a matter of being in the right tree, it's being there at the right time. And avoiding it, if you, you know, even if it's the only day you have to hunt that week, if things aren't right, just stay right away from it, you know, and wait until it is. Save up your vacation days. If you got personal days or whatever that you can take, wait until the weather's right and take one, you know.
Well, do you find maybe that these public pieces, if the other guys are doing the same thing every time, that the deer, you know, pick up on what they're doing and stuff, and that changes their habits too?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Because, they're, you know, I've watched them. A lot of times the guys will do the same thing every time they go in, you know. They'll leave a parking area and they access the woods, you know, or their hunting ground the same way.
No doubt, yeah. And I think they're watching that. I think the deer know that just as well as we do. You know, they're... Dude, actually, just tonight, I was down at this... This is a new property, you know. I just did a quick scout of it in March. That was one of the only early season ones, or not early, but postseason ones that we did. Found some good signs, so we thought we'd go back to it. I hunted it Friday. We did okay there, and the only reason we went there because we were flooded out of everywhere else. But mm-hmm. Today I went back there, and just on a whim, I decided I was going to follow this little ditch line that went out into the middle of this wide open field. There's nothing out there, but there's a little clump of grass, and just this one little willow on the edge of it, just a little willow brush. And I walked along that thing, and sure enough, there's a bed right there at the base of that thing. And I could see my truck from it. I could see the whole, that access point. And any deer could lay right there and watch that and completely undetected, you know, wouldn't even have to get up and move. You know, nobody's going to walk down that ditch line. There was a bed underneath there. I think they probably do that more than we know.
So in that field where you said that you could see the deer in the field and they could see the parking area, and the hunting was close. How did you access that? And you know, were you able to be successful in doing so there, or how did that go?
Yeah. So. This is a fun story. the outcome of it isn't fun for me, but the tactics are wonderful. Everything played out perfect. It was one of those that I had seen a handful of good bucks in the area, and the bedding area sort of sat on the northwest corner of this section, basically from where the parking area is. And there was quite a bit of, there's a bean field and then sort of a all swamp grass section before you get into the bedding area. And anything out in those beans or the swamp grass or on the other side of it can see all the way to the parking lot. And although it's, you know, a few hundred yards away all the way to the bedding, I'd watch guys park and walk right along those field edges and all the way back towards the bedding and climb up in the nearest tree to the edge of it and expect that they're going to kill deer, you know. And it's like, I could see what they were doing from my tree. There's another woodlot that was a little ways away from there. And I was like, shoot, if I can see what you're doing, every deer that's out here can see what you're doing. And so that was sort of what made me want to sort of devise a plan to get into the back side of the bedding. Crazy thick in there. And so what I found was, this might be taboo. I mean, for a lot of guys, it's like you never hunt a bedding area in the morning. Trying to cut them off coming to bed is a bad idea. And it typically is. But this particular spot has a drainage on the north side of it. It's a big drainage. And the best bedding is tucked right up close to it. So I sort of knew that if a buck's going to bed there, they're going to come from the fields to the south, work their way through all the thick, you know, sort of thick stuff, and then they're going to get to the really thick stuff right along this ditch line. If they're going to bed there, they'll be getting there, you know, the latest. So that's my best chance to shoot one basically right at daybreak. So what I kind of did, I said, I'm going to get in there crazy early, like in my tree, set up, hour and a half, almost 2 hours before the sun came up. So it's a crazy early morning. It's a little over hour drive for me. You know, it's not the type of thing that you just say, oh, I'm going to go hunting this morning. This one was pretty calculated. I had the right wind. I needed a southerly wind. So that worked for me. But I also really wanted rain, just because the whole edge of that ditch line could be pretty crunchy getting into there. There's a lot of trees along the edge there that had been trimmed and stuff while they were clearing out a ditch. So there's a lot of stuff that could potentially be crunchy. So rain was helpful. So I had the day that I needed. And the tricky part was getting across that field. So I figured if the deer were in the field, they're going to be south of the bedding. And that's where the parking is. But there is also, at the farthest east end of the property, there's another access point that I basically figured if I could park way down there and walk up the field edge, then I'd be able to get back to my spot, circle back around. But the other problem that I had was I didn't want to leave the parking lot empty and have somebody else pull into there. It seemed like every time I'd, you know, pull into that parking spot, if someone else pulled in there, they'd usually go, hey, I'm just going to go to this other spot down the road. So I wanted to leave my car parked at the most typical access point so it would deter other hunters from going in there and messing up my plan. But then I still had to get 3/4 of a mile down the road to the other end of the property to access it, you know. So I did. I parked my car there. I mean, we're talking almost middle of the night, you know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever. Parked the car and walked down the road and circled all the way back around down the drainage, and then was able to get into my tree that I wanted to get into. Got into there clean. I didn't bump anything out of the field that I knew of. Nothing blew at me, nothing took off running. I didn't see any tails. So I was really, really hoping that I didn't, you know, totally screw up the whole field. But by the time I got into there, I was in my tree and overlooking this really thick bedding area. It's got there's a patch of, I don't even know what they are. It's just a real thick patch of brush in the middle of it and a bunch of swamp grass all the way around it. And sure enough, I mean, just shortly after daybreak, he came wandering into there, and it was like, I don't know if you ever seen a buck in his bedroom, but they're like a different animal in there. Like, he was not on edge at all. He was just tiptoeing into his bed. You know, it was like he's almost there. And when he came into my field of view, I had the camera rolling on him, and I was dialed right in. And he's coming in, and strangest thing, there was a deadfall that was laying there that I figured would funnel him straight to me before he'd turn and jump into his bed there. Well, he ended up, as soon as I had almost a shot at him, he jumped right through the middle of a deadfall. And it's a pretty funny video because you wouldn't think this thing with a great big piece of headgear on would jump through the middle of a downed tree, but he did, and squirted right into there, and then he actually laid down in his bed for quite a while. I stood there just thinking, he's dead to rights. As soon as he stands up, I'm going to have an arrow through him in no time. And so I had him ranged at 35 yards laying in there. Well, he got up, and he got circled around the close side of it to me, and I don't even remember how fast it happened. It was so fast I didn't even have time to hit record. I thought I did, but when he popped up out of his bed, all of a sudden he was circling around in the front of it, and it was almost like he was going to jump back into there and bed down again. I don't know if it was because he was wanting a better view or what, but he sort of circled around it and then looked like he was going to jump right back in the middle of it. I went to take a 35-yard shot that was actually more like a 30-yard shot, and back, and away he went. Out of my life, and I never did get another crack at him in there. But everything else worked. I mean, if I wouldn't have rushed the shot, and if I would have taken my time and done my part of it, you know, as far as the shooting, it would have been an awesome story. But
well, it still was.
Yeah, it was a good story. Absolutely. For you guys.
Because we've all been there, that's why.
Oh, good. I'm not the only one that's ever missed a big buck. Oh, no. This particular one, he had a third main beam on him, and he was just a really nice buck. Just one of those that super unique, lots of character, and didn't pan out, but the tactics there, you know, you talk about thinking outside of the box, and I think that's a key to just about anything, but, you know, it really applies well. There's easy hunting that can be good, can be decent, and then there's that next level that, you know, when you get out of your car and you don't just, you know, walk down the field edge like everybody else and climb up into your tree stand on the field edge like everybody else, there's a lot more opportunity, you know, when you start doing something different. So sometimes it just takes doing a little bit of homework and looking at maps and trying to figure out, hey, you know, where are people most prone to be? And if you kind of highlight those spots, I think the deer are doing the same thing. So I just, you know, I try to stay away from that for the most part. You know, sometimes you don't have an option. You're limited in space, you know, size of the property or whatever. But no. If you got the opportunity to do something different,
what size properties are you looking for though? I mean, you know, what you're talking about there?
Yeah. I usually don't go for anything too small, like less than 20 acres. Every once in a while, I will, but usually I scout those ones when I'm turkey hunting in the spring. So I'll take those smaller ones because usually if you're turkey hunting in the spring, you can find whether or not there's deer there and then whether or not there's other hunter signs. You know, have guys been setting up ladder stands or hang on? Sometimes they're even left out there.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if you look for those, you know, the typical spots where you would expect somebody to, you know, park the truck and go walk the field edge, climb up and stand. If you find evidence of people there, I just stay right away from it, you know, in the fall. But a lot of the time, I'm looking for pieces of property that I can move around on. You know, if I run into somebody while I'm out there, I don't really want to have to leave. I'd rather say, okay, you've got this area, I'm going to move along to a different section.
Well, being mobile is like, you know, that's the way to hunt, though. I mean, that's,
yeah, you know, yeah.
I've always hunted that.
Yep. I'm a big advocate of that these days. I mean, I've been saddle hunting for, this is my 10th season now, and I find that, you know, I can walk around with my saddle on, and I've got everything I need to climb and hunt and everything in just my small day pack, and I can be really mobile. So if I find a spot that looks good, I can hunt it. If somebody else is there, I can keep on moving, and I don't feel like, oh, crap, I got to pack up my big old climber again or whatever. I did that for a couple years, and it just wasn't for me.
The thing is, though, you know, like if you go into an area, I kind of like them guys that put the ladder stands in because you know where they're going to be, you know? I mean, yep. they're in areas, you know, that they're not moving, you know, that's where they're going to hunt, you know? There must be guys that, you know, it's possibly they just hunt the weekends or whatever, you know, or evening or something. But they're, you know, they're in there, and I say, okay, there's, you know, three or four of them in here. You know, we're going to hunt over here.
Exactly. Yep. And you usually find those ones in the spots you would expect to find them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're very rarely tucked in somewhere where, you know, where you'd expect to find a big buck.
So, you know, so let's say that you're talking to, or the listener here is the ladder stand guy, the field edge guy, or the always hunted the same stand on his piece of private land guy, and they say, well, I don't want to go out there because I don't know where to go, or, you know, I go out there and I don't know what kind of sign I'm looking for. You know, how are you locating these, outside of like glassing on the field edges and stuff, what are you using to target, you know, 100-inch deer in Michigan, which, like you said, and especially now, I think there are, you know, Michigan's coming along. There's bigger deer being killed, you know, every year. But it's still a tall order, and people say, well, you know, I just want to get my buck, or, you know, I just want to go out there and hunt. But a lot of that is that they don't know what they're looking for, or like how they're breaking this sort of stuff down. So how do you go about, you know, locating the larger age class deer on these properties?
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm really coming to understand more and more of is looking at transition lines. Deer are edge creatures, right? So you're very rarely going to be looking for a big buck in the daylight in open timber. You know, you may find them during the rut when a hot doe goes cruising through there, but, you know, early season, you know, until you get into late October, you're really not, you know, in open timber, most likely you're not going to find a buck in the daylight, not a big buck. You know, you might get lucky, especially like opening weekends, before there's any pressure that's been applied, you might find them coming to some acorns or something in the open. But I usually try to find the edges of those areas. Look for the thick cover, and then the closest food that I can find to the cover. And this is stuff that, you know, I'm just basically regurgitating other people's information. You know, this is stuff that I've learned by reading and listening to John Eberhardt and Dan Infault and the guys that are, you know, that have been historically getting it done year after year after year. But, you know, if you can find a isolated oak tree that's real close to a thick swamp, there's a good chance that if it's dropping acorns and stuff, that's going to be the first spot that a buck's going to come out to just before, you know, it's totally dark. So you may get a chance at it if you can shoot, you know, to that tree. And I actually found one of those just the other day. I was walking through the edge of it was just basically an oak flat. There was a whole bunch of red oaks in it, and I started moving towards the thicker cover, and it got real wet, and then I found just this one little island, and it might have been 40 or 50 yards around, but there was one lone oak tree. It was a white oak, and it was just spewing acorns. And it was like, well, this is okay. The sky's opened up, and here we go. I'm going to climb a tree here and kill a deer. And I ended up killing a doe there. I mean, four of them came in, and three of them left on their feet, you know. And those are the types of places that usually I'm looking for something that's different than just sitting in the open woods. I don't necessarily look for a place where I can see tons of deer. I used to love sitting on field edges on all the leases and stuff that I've had, just because you can always see, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 deer a night, you know, but you're not seeing the deer that you want to see, you know. So when I'm looking for big bucks specifically, I'm looking for rub lines and scrapes. If you can find scrapes, that's great. But, you know, the rub lines will tell you a pretty good story, too. If you can find them coming out of that thick cover, you'll know whether, hey, they're getting out of their bed and they're hitting every tree coming out of here, and they're definitely using this trail. Then you can start paying attention to wind direction and how you need to set up looking over them. And if you can find where that's, you know, connecting the dots, going to some real close food, those acorns or anything else that you can find, that's usually a really good starting point, because it's usually not too far. I mean, that's not like you got to walk 3 miles deep into a swamp and, you know, go swimming to find a deer. That's just when you start trying to get yourself separated from where the doe groups are coming out, you start actually finding where, you know, you're getting into a, you know, little different classification of deer. And that's been a fun journey for me, because I like to see a lot of deer, for one, but I like actually getting past all those big numbers of deer that are the first ones out to the field, the ones that are, you know, they're not the ones I'm trying to target most of the time. But when you start moving into the thicker cover, that's usually where I expect that I'm going to see bucks. And it usually does happen. Now, granted, I mean, we are in Michigan, so I see a ton of spikes and 4 points and 6 points and stuff where they just can't grow fast enough, no matter how much I wish. you know, that's usually what I'm looking for. It's usually for, like, the guy that, you know, that's asking me, hey, how do I try to find the big deer? That's usually the jumping off point, you know. Look for the thickest cover closest to the food and start digging into it. Move a little bit further in. If you don't find them there, move a little bit further in. If you don't find them there, just keep on moving until you do. And, you know, eventually you'll either end up being able to hunt the deer, or you'll, you know, sometimes you bump them. Sometimes they do see you coming or whatever, and you learn something from it. And usually I leave those spots alone for a couple of days before I go back to them. But if I bump a big deer, if I know one's in there, I usually go back. So
you're looking for the transition lines and things like that. And when you're walking through the woods, I mean, Frank, for years and years and years, this is one of those old school woodsmanship pro tips for the guys that don't know. But if you've ever listened to Frank tell a story, or you ever go hunting with him, or he tells you how to get to a spot, he says, because he doesn't like to go in until gray light anyways, but he says, you go in and you'll just look over there, and when you see the woods change, where you'll start to see it getting light over there, that's that edge. And so you'll go down there, and then it makes another edge. and those are those transition lines. So where those two different types of vegetation meet. So even when you're going in the dark, and if you're on a property that you haven't ever been on before, you know, that's something that you can pick up on, you know, fairly easily. But when you're looking at Onyx and stuff like that, because you had I think it was last year, a pretty good hunt with you and your hunting partner, where you just picked out a spot on Onyx on the map and had a pretty good experience. So when you're looking at Onyx, just on a map, on a big old, you know, sea of green and a couple transition lines where you can't go in and see the rub lines. You can't see scrapes or anything like that. You're just looking at a map. How are you breaking that down and maybe in doing so, you know, kind of outline what happened on that hunt and how it all came together, like your thought process there?
Yeah. So that particular one, what I was looking at was there was a pretty substantial section of woods that was attached to an ag field. And you know the ag field, especially a secluded one. This one was a long way off the road. You know that's going to get just hammered by the deer. So what I'm looking for in a case like that, where I'm looking at this ag field, I'm looking at this block of woods, and then everything around the area, I'm basically looking for those transition lines again. I was looking at a marsh to the north of this ag field and a huge block of woods to the west of it. I looked at the marsh to the north and I said, boy, that transition line looks really good. It really, really looked thick going into there. And I said, man, if there was a deer that was wanting to get as far away as he could from any sort of human intrusion, he's going to get to the edge of that marsh, you know, right where it transitions from the sort of standing timber inside of there. It was pretty sparse, but there's timber there. And then it basically just turns into swamp grass, just really, really wet, thick stuff. And there's these little clumps of high ground out there. You can see these little clumps of red brush or trees that were out in there. There was nothing that was, you know, as it turned out, once we got boots on the ground, there was nothing that was like oaks or anything out there, like little oak islands that would have been awesome. But looking at all those little clumps out there, you know that there's high ground. And that high ground is where they're going to retreat to and bed, if they're going to, if they're going to need to get that far away from people. This particular hunt was a drawing. It was a lottery hunt. So in order to be able to hunt there, we had to get drawn. Once we got drawn, we had basically a day we could go scout it. And the way that it played out, we decided that we would walk through that big section of timber just right parallel with the ag field and see what we could see in there for one, but I really wanted to get into that marsh. I had dropped a pin on Onyx, actually a couple of them along that transition line on the marsh, and said, we got to scout this. It was one of those, I could see this little row of those clumps of what looked like, you know, potential bedding going out into that marsh. And so as we were going through the woods, we actually got to the far north end of it. And when, you know, basically the open timber ended and we got into the real thick stuff that was growing along, there's a drainage along there and it just kind of drops off into that area. And it got real thick. It was one of those, that's where the woods changed. As we were, you know, working our way along that, we bumped a couple of good bucks. I mean, probably 110, 120 range. Bumped them right out of their beds. And I mean, we weren't very far at all from that marsh. Probably within 200 yards of where we ended up killing bucks. Basically, the way that played out, we got that bedding, and we decided, wow, this looks like a really good spot, and it's pretty close to the ag fields. There was a lot of good sign in there, so we decided we would probably hunt that spot, but if it didn't pan out, we'd go up and try the marsh, but we weren't going to be able to access it that way because we had to walk through all sorts of bedding to get to that marsh, or potential bedding. So that was another one of those. I had to devise a different plan, so I picked up a boat and we were able to float down a river, basically, and work their way into it. But one of the things that we really learned there was, you know, we hunted that timber. We had definitely, we had bumped two shooter bucks out of it. And so kind of one of those, you know, I'd like to give them a fair shot before we move into that marsh and try anything else. So we decided we'd hunt that the first day, and we got into there and we saw some deer. We ended up, John shot a doe the first night, and I didn't shoot anything. I saw quite a few deer. The next morning I saw a good 10 point, but he didn't, and it was right by that bed too, but he didn't get close enough to me. We ended up hunting there, and we ran into people. It was one of those spots that was, it was a long way back in there, but fairly easy walk to get that mile back in. So we ended up running into people. So by day three, we decided we were going to take the boat and go back into that marsh. And this is where, you know, your question, you know, how did you pick a spot and then go hunt it successfully? You know, looking at the way that particular piece sort of laid out, it was kind of like L-shaped. So there's a river that's running on the west side of it from the north to the south. And we were able to access along the river. And it sort of takes a turn and sort of runs east to west and sort of pinches off. There's sort of a almost a natural choke point there. So I dropped a pin there just thinking, boy, that really looks good because it's a natural choke point for one. Sort of the woods thins down a little bit, but then it was right at the base of where this little strip of those bedding pieces went right out into the marsh. And this was all just basically from looking at Onyx. It was not, you know, boots on the ground scouting yet, but we decided we'd give it a try in the middle of the day. So we hopped in the boat, we went up there, and we got out of the boat and started walking along this little ditch in the middle of this marsh grass. And within 10 steps out of the boat, we found a scrape. And I mean, it pretty much confirmed, hey, we want to stay here and hunt a little bit. So we start walking along the edge of this thing just thinking, we have no idea what we're getting into. It was pretty much all flooded timber, which that's just a whole different thing to me. You know, that flooded timber isn't something that I would normally say, hey, let's go hunt that. But the sign led us there because we had seen deer that had gone farther north when we were hunting in that back corner of that a big patch of woods, so we knew that deer had to be back in there. Well, once we found that first scrape right by where we landed our boat, it was like, oh, cool, we're onto something. So we started walking along the edge of that, going straight towards my where I dropped my pin on X. And we were about halfway across this patch of timber when, I mean, we're not even talking, oh, maybe 80 or 90 yards from the boat, we spotted a doe coming our direction. And this is early November, so rut's on, you know. And so we see a doe, and she's coming our way, and I had a doe tag for one, as well as two buck tags, and John had filled his doe tag already, so he was waiting on a buck. So this doe was coming right at us. So he says, knock an arrow, you can take her, you know, and we'll just kneel down right here. When she comes through, I'll shoot her. So he's going to run the camera for me and stuff. And I knocked an arrow, got ready. And as she got closer, we saw a buck behind her. And we're going, holy cow, we're not even out of the boat for 5 minutes here. And here comes this buck, and he's chasing her, and they're coming right in our direction. They stopped about 60 yards out, and she was sort of actually going straight towards where I was expecting that we were going to find them, a little bit farther away, towards where I had initially thought I'd go hunt. And so she starts walking away, So I grabbed my grunt and hit that real quick and trying to get the buck to come to us. He looked in our direction, didn't want anything, didn't want anything to do with us. So we hit the can call, and all of a sudden, right on the same trail that we just walked in on, this little four-point comes running right down the trail and got within about 10 feet of us before he spooked. So we haven't even been out of the boat for 10 minutes, and we've got, you know, two bucks and a doe and smiles galore. We're like, holy cow, we found it, you know. So it was a really cool thing, you know. Well, then we watched those two kind of fade off into the distance. They kept heading to the east, and there was a bunch of willow brush and everything back in there that they just sort of disappeared into. And I tried to continue stalking along after them for a couple minutes there, but then they were getting away from me too fast. So we decided that was going to be the spot we'd climb up in the trees. So John climbed one, and I went right over to my initial location that I had planned on, climbed the tree, and as I was on my second step that I was mounting on the tree, this doe and another smaller buck, it was a 6-point, they came right out, and he was actually swimming around chasing her. They were going through a really deep hole that was right next to my tree. I just kept climbing the tree going, holy cow, we're covered up in deer, and they're swimming around in there. It was crazy. And I'd have never dreamed it. I would have never imagined how in the world would deer live back there, but they were all over the place in there. So I climbed the tree. I no sooner than pulled my bow up and hung it up, I'm clipped into my saddle and, you know, just getting dialed in, when the first doe and buck came out, and he was a 10-point. He was a good 10-point, about 120-inch deer. And he chased the doe, sort of makes a great big arc just past me, out of range, going straight towards John. And I'm going, holy cow, this is not happening. You know, we just got into here, barely even clipped in, and this thing's going straight to John. This is too good to be true. Well, I'm sitting there watching with my binoculars. This is probably one of my coolest memories, too, because just pretty unique. But I'm from my tree, I can see this deer going over towards John, and I can't see John. He's probably 150 yards from me, and we're both up in the trees, so the canopy's kind of blocking him from my sight. But I can see the deer clear as day in my binoculars, and I saw it before I heard it, and I watched his arrow pass clean through that buck. And it was the coolest thing. I was zoomed right in and saw the arrow zip through, and the thing ran right towards me and ended up dying about 40 yards from me. So it's actually submerged in water where it finally crashed. Its head's underwater, and I, of course, you know, I grabbed my phone. I know John's going to call me any second, you know. So I actually called him first, I think, and I'm like, dude, that was awesome. I watched your arrow go right through him, and he didn't see where the thing had gone, so he was really relieved when I said, I'm looking right at him. He's 40 yards in front of me, and he's like, that's awesome. Well, then right then another buck showed up. It was an 8-point, and he's like a 90-inch 8-point, and the thing comes right along the same trail, goes right towards John's dead deer, or dying deer at the time, and stands right there, about 10 feet away from him. And his deer picks up his head and takes a big old breath of air, so he's just, you know, gurgling and trying to get his last breath. And, well, it spooked that 8-point closer to me, and he's standing right there, and John's like, he's a good buck. Are you going to shoot him? I said, if he gives me a shot, yeah. I'm lowering my standards for this one because this is an awesome story. And so I put my phone in my pocket, and the thing picked his head up again one more time, took his very last breath that time. Well, that was all she wrote. That 8-point had nothing to do with standing next to that thing. And he bounded in my direction, and he got to about 25 yards right in the open, standing in the water, and I just smoked him. And, I mean, he didn't even go 30 yards and actually went into that same big pool of water that other 6-point had chased that doe through. He ended up dying out there in the water. Made me swim to find him. But
it was underwater.
That was a he died in the water. Yep.
Oh yep. My gosh.
Yeah, it was bad. Well, it was November. It was early November. I had to go out there and retrieve him. I had my knee boots on, and so I was chest deep in that water to get him out of there. And we had only been in our trees, hadn't even left the boat for 45 minutes. We had two deer dead.
It's awesome. And
that was a really cool experience. We ended up with both of those ones that day. We went home. The next day we got up and decided we weren't going to hunt because we both had to dry all of our stuff. We decided we weren't going to go back there again without waders. So we went shopping that day and bought some decent waders. And then had our deer checked. We had to go to the check station and all that stuff. And then the very next day we went back in there. We decided to go back in for a morning hunt. We were going to go to the same trees. So as we're walking in, we're basically halfway through the timber. John gets in his tree. I went the rest of the way through the timber to get in my tree. And as I got to the base of my tree, my phone goes off, vibrates in my pocket. And he's like, "Don't move. I've got a buck coming in already." And I look back, and there he is. I can see him in his tree. And he's at full draw. Whack! Lets it go, and he shoots another 10-point.
Oh, my gosh.
It was one of those, it was like, how in the world is this happening? We found just a honey hole. And so we ended up getting his out of there. And then on the last night of the hunt, the last night we were able to be in there, actually it was a whole day, all day set that we had, but we had 5 different bucks chase 1 hot doe. She was actually, she had about 150-inch 10-point right on her. We actually watched them breed her 4 times that day, and they were within about 80 to 100 yards of us for about 6 hours. And we were right in the, there was no way we were going to get anywhere closer to them until about an hour before dark. They moved off on us where I could actually climb down and try to pull off a stalk. And I got pretty close, but not close enough, and I ended up zipping an arrow right underneath of his belly. Misjudged the yardage on it. It was like the very last couple minutes of daylight, and I tried to stalk on him. It was open timber and a little bit of marsh grass. He's standing there right in the open, so was I. He's looking right at me, and the only thing keeping him there was the hot doe that was standing right in front of him. Otherwise, he'd have been long gone, because he was just, he was love struck. It was one of those. He's like, "Yeah, I know I should probably run away, but she's right here." And I got as close as I could and ended up missing another deer last year. So,
well, at least you're missing good ones.
All in the same spot,
That's
like,
incredible that worked out for you like that.
That was a fun hunt. That was a really, really cool experience.
So, is that just an access thing? You think those deer are just, nobody goes back there, nobody accesses it like that? Or they go in there and it's kind of like what, the hunting beast guys say, where the water just keeps people away, so.
Yeah, I definitely think water has a lot to do with it. And that's, it's one of those things, I almost hesitate to say that, because the more guys hear that, the more everybody goes, "Well, I just got to get past the water." And I am starting to see more guys that are using, I guess, what you'd call more extreme tactics to get to those spots. It seems like almost everywhere I go now, I find some sort of human sign. So it's not like it doesn't happen at all. It's just not happening by the masses, So there's definitely things that separate the crowd, from some of that really good hunting that's available. And some of those spots, they can't handle pressure either. So you know, we were pretty fortunate in that spot just because it was the rut and there was a family of does that were living real close there. And it seemed like every time that we were in there, something was being chased around. So that was timing for one. I don't know if it would be that good if I went in there today to hunt it, but it was definitely holding, you know, some does in there that just pulled the bucks into them, and they felt safe enough to run around in that open timber, flooded but open. And boy, it left them awfully vulnerable. So those are those things that, like, you know, getting in a boat and going for a mile boat ride to get back into there, not everybody's going to do that. So yeah, it was definitely access that was our advantage there. And that was, it was actually kind of funny. The story behind getting the boat and actually using it was, that was all my doing. And John was really reluctant at first because we were seeing lots of deer up in that section of woods, but they just weren't the deer that we wanted. And after seeing a few other people in there, I finally said, it's time to do something different. We've only got a week to do this, you know, and we better not waste our time. Let's at least go explore this spot that I had initially dropped a couple pins in. And so it was kind of one of those, let's get out of our stands at 10 o'clock this morning. We'll drive around to the spot where we figured we'd take the boat off the trailer and hike it back to the river and put it in. And then we had the boat for a mile upstream and then start scouting and hunting. And the look on his face was like, you really want to do this? He's usually pretty agreeable, but this one, there was no excitement in his face. So, you know, and he's a hardcore hunter just like me, you know, but so, you know, there's a lot of guys that aren't going to be doing that stuff. And I guess that's another piece of advice when you ask, hey, what kind of advice would you give? You know, looking for transition lines and, you know, rubs and stuff like that, food and everything, that's a really good jumping off point. But the other thing is to do the stuff that seems uncomfortable and, you know, follow up on those thoughts of, boy, I wonder if, you know, there might be deer back there. You know, to me, it's never a wasted day if I'm trying something like that, even if I come up empty-handed, because I'll still learn something. I just hate the idea of laying in bed at night going, man, you know, I think tomorrow I'm going to go check that spot out, and then I don't, and then the next night I'm going, man, I wish I would have, you know. I don't like that feeling. So I'd rather scout something that I thought was good and find out that it's not than wonder and then kick myself for not going into it. So.
Well, that sounds like Frank's hunting partner who's scout hunt. And, I mean, he does well, but that look you're talking about is the look that I get from Frank just about every time I tell him I'm going to do something. He says, you're going to do what? I took him back in over Labor Day weekend to check my trail cams or go retrieve one of my trail cameras, and he's like, what the hell are you doing back here? Like, we had to pole across this one log, and we walked. I mean,
well, I've always, you know, I've hunted river bottoms and stuff for years, you know, so it's either hip boots or waders, you know, or something. Knee boots, no. We're not going, you know, you're not going into this stuff. And he goes, he's like walking out in it, and I'm going, you're going to get a wet ass, dude. I'm telling you right now, you know.
Yep.
Well, whatever. You'll never know how deep that water is until you step in it. Right? It doesn't look that deep.
Oh, it shouldn't be over your boots in here. Oh, it is.
Yeah. So when you dropped that pin, was your initial plan water access then?
No, actually my initial plan was we were going to walk through that timber, through the section of woods. There was, I figured we would probably walk along the river, but through the woods to access it. And I looked at it thinking, boy, you know, water access would be great, but I didn't have a boat that would work for it. You know, like, I've got a good fishing boat, but I'm not carrying the thing anywhere. And I didn't feel like canoeing down that river for a mile in November with deer, you know, if we did get one. So it was just kind of one of those, I didn't even think about water access at first. We just basically thought, we'll go through the woods. Well, that plan basically had to change because everything on the north end of those woods was bedding. So there was just, there was no sense trying to walk through that stuff to access that marsh. Because if there was stuff in it, we were going to blow it out. So it really became pretty clear the day that we scouted it and we bumped those bucks out of there that the only way to access that marsh is going to be by boat. So
is this a rowboat?
Yeah. It was a little 12-foot aluminum rowboat that a friend of mine owns it. It was one of those, I was looking for a boat, you know, so I was just asking friends and stuff, hey, does anybody have one for sale? You know, that a lot of people have them laying back behind their sheds or something that they don't use. So I just kind of put my feelers out there, and a friend of mine responded and said, yeah, I've got one you can use. It just sits out back by my pond. And he goes, you can use it all you want. So I didn't have to go buy one or anything. And so we got that, and he even had a little electric trolling motor for it. So I pulled my battery out of my boat and got it all charged up and ready to go. And we just had to carry the thing a little ways and put it down into the river. And it's about a mile by boat. So not a, you know, not a really long boat ride, but I mean, it took some time. Matter of fact, yeah, it turned into being, you know, about perfect, because that first day that we hunted in there, we had both of our bucks, his 10 and my 8, and they were both right in the bow of that boat, and then the two of us were floating back down that river going, man, I hope this doesn't have a leak in it or anything. Oh, man, I was super glad that I didn't decide I'd go with one of the canoes that we got out here, so.
Yeah, that would have been an interesting endeavor. So you had mentioned going out of state a couple times and coming home with unfilled tags. How does your standards change going out of state with, like, you know, cost of the tag, all that? Because, you know, sometimes, you know, guys are like, well, it's the last day, so I'm going to shoot whatever. Just going to, you know, I'm not coming back, so my tag is X. Or, you know, even more, like when we were in Ohio, it was, you know, there's just deer that you just weren't going to shoot, or what didn't meet your expectation, like no matter the day. So what's your outlook on going out of state?
Yeah, great question. I have a, I don't know if it's an unpopular view or if it's popular or not, but it's mine. But basically, out of state, my goal is a Pope and Young class deer. And for some guys, it's any buck. For some guys, it's way bigger than that. You know, but if I can shoot 125, 130-inch deer, that's awesome. You know, I always want to kill something bigger than what I've got here in Michigan available to me. And so I'm always looking for that. So that's kind of my jumping-off point. And when it comes to the cost of the tag, I look at it like, man, I have no problem paying for an experience. I don't mind paying for stories and for the, you know, the education that you get from it and all that stuff. So if I come back with an unfilled tag, it's not the end of the world. You know, it's not like, yeah, I'd love to bring home the meat and a trophy and, you know, have another head to drop off at the taxidermist. But at the end of the day, do I really need the meat? Do I really need another taxidermy bill? Do I really need another, you know, I'm not going to put another 110-inch buck on the wall, you know. And these are my standards. And it doesn't mean that, you know, that has to apply to everybody else. So for guys that are listening, you know, that's not, I'm not looking down on anybody for any of that stuff. I'll never shame anybody for what they kill, that's for sure. If you want to shoot a spike or a four-point or whatever out of state, I don't care. You shoot your thing. Whatever makes you happy and gives you good stories. But So that, for me, like, I don't mind that. I don't mind eating a tag, you know, burning that. That's kind of the cost of the experience to me. You know, and I actually played that out in Ohio a few years ago. I was down there. The very first sit, the first night, we had gotten down there actually pretty late in the day, and weren't even expecting to hunt that day. We were going to go out the following day. It was so late, but decided, hey, you know what, I'm going to go to this one spot that I had picked out on the map that looked like fairly easy access. I'd be able to get into it, just had to cross a little river, and so I found a deadfall, crossed the river, tiptoeing across this dead tree, got down into this little spot where these 2 points came down into this little river valley, and sure enough, I had about 115-inch 8-point that came right to me. I mean, the last half hour of the day, the thing walked within 20 yards of me, and I let it walk. Got back to camp and everything, and boy, you know, everybody's like, why would you let the thing go? You know, well, the first night here, and that's not why I came to Ohio, you know. And of course, you get the question, well, would you shoot it on your last day, you know? And of course, I say, no, I wouldn't, you know. Well, the thing let me actually practice what I preached there, because he did. He showed up on my very last sit in that same valley, not in the same spot, but down in that same valley. He was the last deer I saw there that week. Ended up being the biggest deer that I saw within range the whole week there. But, you know, just it didn't meet my goal of what I wanted to get out of it, so.
So that was going to be my question. So, like, unequivocally, it didn't meet your goal, because I was going to ask how much of that you saying the first day that you wouldn't that you wouldn't kill it on the last day came into play
there. Right.
You know, right. You're like, oh, well, I got to be a man of my word. Like, you didn't tight string them.
No. No, I actually ran the camera on him and let him go. But, it, you know, and of course you play that through in your head, like, wow, should I, you know, should I just shoot him? Should I, you know, or not? And honestly, you know, even looking back at it, yeah, I still wouldn't have shot him just because, for me, and this is, you know, my situation here, I have access to all sorts of public land, just like you do too, everybody else here, but I've got chunks of private that I can hunt, and I hunt a lot, and I've been blessed to be very successful at that, you know, and so meat, you know, hunting for meat, I can do that just fine here, so I didn't need to come home from an out-of-state hunt with a cooler full of venison to make my wife happy or the family happy, you know, that's going to happen regardless of that trip. So that's one thing. And then the other thing, the way that I sort of look at it is, you know, there's a reason that people go to states like Ohio and Missouri and Kansas and, you know, wherever. There's a reason that people do, and that's because there's opportunity for bigger bucks. And if I go to one of those states and kill a small buck every year in their standards, you know, a lot of the places down there, you know, you shoot 120 deer and the locals laugh at you and go, why would you shoot that, you know? Mm-hmm. And hey, take it for what it is, you know, it's whether it's right or wrong or whatever, I don't know, but I look at it like, hey, you know what, I'm going to leave it here because maybe next year I'll come back and hunt the same area and he'll be a 140, you know, or somebody else will get a chance at a 140 because I let a 120 walk, you know. And that's just sort of my thought process on it. You know, I like to come home with deer, but I don't know. To me, if I set a goal, I sort of like to stick with it for the most part. Sometimes, like last year, you know, the experience is worth changing your goals in the heat of the moment, you know. That's the smallest buck I've shot in 10 years, and probably the best story. So it's not all about inches, you know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I would say there's two things to that, right? One, I think we have the same sort of goals when we go out of state. I mean, that's you're trying to shoot something that you couldn't shoot here. And but I think along with that, and I've heard stories of this from other guys too, but that experience thing is like it's twofold. So you're paying for that experience, you're going out of state for that experience, but you have to think about the experience of the person that's having the experience. So if they've never shot a 8-point, you know, a 70-inch deer here in Michigan, and they get a chance to shoot a 90-inch deer in Missouri, and it's easy, and it's the biggest deer they've ever shot, and, you know, they're excited about it, that's awesome. Who cares? And, you know, if they went there because those deer are more plentiful, you know, more power to them. You know, that's the one thing. You know, everybody is all about inches and this and that. Got to be bigger than the last one I shot, or, you know, some sort of thing. But, you know, that the story, like you said, you know, shooting that deer, which would be, you know, a lot of people's, many people's biggest buck ever. But for you, the story outweighs any of that. And it, you know, it would have been cool if you shot that 6-point just to do it, you know, I mean, to some degree. I mean, to have to go and dig them out of a hole, you know, have to go waist deep. Well, it's chest deep on you, but under in the water. I always got to get that little dig in there on Tim. But yeah, I mean, that story is amazing. And I think, you know, for whatever level of hunter you're at or the experience, I mean, Frank is the mutant slayer. So, you know, that buck you talked about at the beginning, that triple beam type buck, you know, my brother's got one of those on one of the properties that he hunts, and he calls it Frank's buck because it's a mutant, you know? So, yeah, we're headed to Missouri this year. Frank's, then you guys are going to
Nebraska
too. So it should be a good year. And what's your goals, Frank?
We hunted Ohio for 6 years, you know, and you go down there and, it's, like you say, it's you have the opportunity at any time to see a buck bigger than you've ever seen before here, you know, in Michigan. You know, I mean, I've seen some decent deer over the years. You know, I've hunted a long time, and I think earlier in the hunts, you know, I mean, in the years, I saw bigger bucks more often here. You know, it's harder and harder now because of the populace. You know. You have so many people and so much pressure on these deer now. That's why the bigger ones are basically nocturnal till that rut starts, you know, until they're exposed. But I'm looking, you know, I'd like to shoot in Missouri. I'll shoot a 130, you know, 130, and I'll be real happy with it.
All right. So, Tim, normally when John's here, we always ask about your bow setup, but John's not here. So what I want to know is your saddle setup and your climbing system and all of that. Because, you know, there's like myself, you know, first year trying out this whole saddle thing, but there's a lot of guys that are just getting into it, have a lot of questions about the saddle setup. But the thing that I've found most where the learning curve is, the saddle isn't the learning curve, it's the climbing system and the way of being efficient with climbing and or transporting in and out. So, you know, from being in the game for 10 years and the evolution that takes, no matter whether it's a climber or whatever, you know, as you keep going every year, you kind of sharpen your skills a little bit. So what are you using to climb the tree, and what's your whole setup for each one of your hunts?
Yeah, great question. So you're right, it's definitely an evolution. It's one of those things that you look at it and go, every year, boy, can I do something a little bit different, a little bit more efficient. So what I'm using now is a full tethered kit. So tethered mantis saddle with the predator platform. And I just absolutely love that setup. I've got another one that when I take my kids, I can actually let them use one too. So I've got duplicate set. And then, as far as the climbing method, I've been using Hawk helium sticks for a few years now, and I cut them down, basically modified them. There's a lot of guys that have been doing that for the last few years. And that all sort of started from the Saddle Hunter Forum. There's been guys, you know, for years trying to come up with the most efficient, effective way to climb trees without having a whole bunch of bulk or weight. And for me, the weight isn't the biggest thing. It's the bulk. It's just because of my frame size. I'm not a very big guy, so I don't like a full-size stick. Because when I attach it to my pack, it's either sticking up a foot above my head or it's hitting me in the back of the legs when I'm walking. And I cannot stand that. I carried Lone Wolf stick for a year, and I'll never do that again just because of the size. Really liked the function of them, but the Hawk sticks, I cut them down to 24 inches. I actually think I'm going to do it again and go even shorter, but... that's just because I can't stop tinkering. but I like the 24 inches about perfect. For a year, I ran with single-step aiders. So just basically hung those from the bottom two steps, and it was another basically 22-inch step, a loop of tubular webbing, just one-inch tubular webbing with a piece of 11-millimeter rope buried inside of it. Like a stirrup, essentially. So it gives me an extra step just basically out of a piece of rope. And one of those hanging from each stick just gave me extra height. That was a decent way to climb. What I've settled on now for the heliums, I actually bought a five-step black diamond aider. And so the way those work, it's basically like a section of loop that just like a little ladder that you can hang from the stick. So I changed out the rope to the VersaStrap, tethered VersaStrap, and I've got the Lone Wolf Versa button on the stick. So I can actually reach up with my stick and my VersaStrap as high as I can reach and attach the stick. So it's close to 7.5 feet, almost 8 feet to the top of my first stick, and then I hang that five-step aider from the bottom step of the helium stick, and I'm able to climb up there. So for every one helium stick, I can gain 7.5 feet roughly pretty easily. So it gives me the chance to carry less stick, which is less weight, less bulk, all that stuff, and I'm able to get to, you know, 21 feet with three sticks pretty easily, 22 feet, somewhere in there. And then if I want to add any more height with my Predator platform, I can use the aider on that as well and still go higher. So I've gone as high as 21 feet with two sticks and the Predator platform with a five-step aider, just moving along as I go. And I just take a piece of paracord with a little carabiner on the end, attach it to that aider. So as I climb, I pull that aider up with me. I can't drop it. It's attached to me all the time. So I just keep it right with me. And then when I get set up in my tree, I can just ball it up and stick it inside my pack, and I'm good to go. And climbing methods are one of those things that it's such a personal preference thing. You can, if you want to use your regular, hey, run down to the sporting goods store and pick up, you know, your section or your package of four sticks that are, you know, 3 feet or 4 feet long, whatever they are, and put them together and have a preset tree like that, that works just fine too. You know, same with screw-in steps, if you can use those, or climbing spikes, or bolts, or Cranford steps, wild edge steps, anything, they work pretty well. I've got wild edge steps. I ran those exclusively last year, and I really liked those. I still do. I'm still using those a bit, and I'll use four of those with what's called a nader and a swader. Those are two terms that basically just came up from the Saddle Hunter forum that a couple guys on there came up, well, actually a whole bunch of people contributed a whole bunch of stuff trying to come up with nader setups that are basically set up where they cinch around your foot. The one of them has a hook that's strapped to your knee, and the other end of it is looped around your foot, so it's always attached to you. The other foot has one that's strapped around your foot, and then a carabiner at the end of it, and it's about waist high, roughly. So those essentially two steps travel with you. So I mount my first wild edge step at 5 feet, 5.5 feet, roughly. And then I'm able to lift up my leg that has the carabiner wader attached to it, hook in, and then step up and attach my nader, and that's just knee attached nader, whatever. And that attaches there, and then I step up and detach my carabiner from the step on the other foot, and then I can mount my next wild edge step another 5.5 feet high. So for every step, you know, I'm gaining 5.5 feet and only, you know, only attaching one. So I usually carry four of those. I can pretty easily get to 22 feet without adding any extra height for my platform. So usually that Predator platform, I'll go either right at the same level as my top step, or if I need to go higher, I'll go as high as another 4 feet with it pretty easily. So that's, again, you know, there's no right or wrong way to do that stuff. And I always kind of caution people all the time, because climbing can be a really easy thing to do in its most basic form, and it can be extremely complicated if you start adding these, you know, advanced climbing techniques, like climbing with aiders and stuff. So it's really not for everyone, and I really kind of caution people from starting that way. You know, don't just think that you're going to pick up a set of, you know, a nader and a swader set up, or a five-step aider or whatever, and think that you're just going to be able to go out and use that like you would if you were just attaching, name your brand, stick to the tree and climbing up. It's something that requires some practice, and something that you have to, you know, put the time in at low level, not trying to go to hunting height, you know. Definitely grab one stick, clip it on, step it on, whatever you're doing, and then practice with an aider, just going up one stick high until you master that and you can't do it wrong before you start going higher. It's one of those things that, with the explosion of saddle hunting and the lightweight, you know, craze that's going on right now, boy, it just scares me, because a lot of people that have virtually zero experience are trying stuff that they really shouldn't yet, so...
And so how does that change when you're hunting with your kids? Because if you're moving that up with you, you can't do that.
Right. Well, that's basically why I keep the climbing sticks, the helium sticks. I usually hunt lower for one with almost all the kids. My oldest boy, Ben, he's 12 now, and I think the kid, I know he can out-climb me. He's just he's a natural climber. So I don't worry a whole lot with him. The only thing I worry about is him being tied in. So usually I carry a lifeline, just like you would for any tree stand setup. So pick your brand, whether it's a Muddy or Hunter Safety System, whatever. Same thing, lifeline with a Prusik on it. And I attach that at the base of the tree, and keep the other end of it with me as I climb. When I get up to hunting height, I tie it off, and then I have him clip right in to that prusik and then just advance that up the rope as he climbs. So he doesn't have to worry about lineman's rope. Like, I'm always climbing with a lineman's rope. I'm all about safety, you know, with four kids and a wife that depend on me to come home after the end of every day of work and every time I go hunting and everything. Boy, I'm always focusing on being as safe as I can. So I use that lineman's belt, but I don't want my kids to have to use one if I can do something that's even safer. So that lifeline is great. And they just climb right up and slide that prusik up as they climb. And they're even climbing the five-step aider like it's nothing. It's amazing how quickly a kid will learn that stuff. They're like little sponges, and plus they're much more flexible, and seems like every one of them climb right up that thing like it's no big deal. You know, I guess it's kind of like their little rope ladder on their playset, you know, so they're used to their steps moving around a little bit, I guess. But it works great. And then once they get up there, I put another tether on the tree that they'll clip into and let go of the one on the lifeline. We've tried it with the lifeline just being the tether, but the problem is that it still attached the tree all the way down, so as the kid moves, the rope moves, and that can just cause extra movement down at the ground level, so don't want to alert the deer with that.
Yeah, that makes sense. So
yeah, but it is a phenomenal way to hunt with your kids. I mean, actually to hunt with it, you know, if you're hunting two people in a tree, it's so cool because you're face-to-face. I usually hunt my kids, myself, we're all right-handed, right? So their bow hand, they're holding it with their left hand. I stay on their right, and so on their weak side, I can run a video camera and stay right there close to them, and we can basically be face-to-face. I can communicate without having to, you know, neither of us are looking over our shoulders, you know, talking in the opposite directions. We're looking right at each other the whole time. It's a pretty slick way to hunt together. So, I mean, they think it's great. I mean, kids are like, oh, it's just like a mini hammock, you know. They climb up in there. They think it's the coolest thing in the world. So, man, I tell everybody, you know, if you're hunting with kids, the saddle system is definitely the way to go. There's no safer way to be in a tree. They're always attached to that thing. They can't not be attached to it. And even if they slip off the platform, they're still dangling from the same rope that they, you know, that they were already. So there's no dynamic load that can be, you know, applied to it.
Well, awesome. Yeah, the you know, I'm wading through those waters right now myself with the climbing systems and all of that. And, you know, I basically own all of them. And you know, it's just, it is figuring out how to do it, what to do. And then I get a lot of questions. How do you like this? How do you like that? And, you know, you see all these guys that are doing one thing or the other, and the learning curve on some of it is steep. And then it seems like, you know, if you want to be lighter, then there's pros and cons to everything. So you're going to be lighter, but you're going to sacrifice this. And then you want to just be convenient, it's going to be heavier, and it's going to be this. And if you don't want to have to DIY anything, then you're left over here. So,
right.
You know, that's, you know, great information, because like I say, you've been doing it for 10 years and that's kind of where you've landed. And, you know, with the saddle right. hunters, you know, now everything is, you know, somewhat readily available, but you know, you guys came up making it all, sewing it yourself, duct tape and super glue, and maybe this will work type stuff. So,
yeah. Well, that's where it's nice to have places where you can get hands-on experience with it, try it before you buy it. And it's becoming much, you know, much more available than what it was. You know, and there's resources out there. There's places that you can go if you're interested in getting into saddle systems or climbing methods. You know, we all seem to be climbing method geek. And like you say, you know, I've got the same thing as you. I've got them all, you know, or I've tried them all. So, you know, guys are available for that stuff, myself included. So for anybody that's listening, if you want to, you know, reach out, get a hold of me, I'm always available. I run the Michigan Saddle Hunters Facebook page, so I'm easy to access there. And I've got a full tethered kit. Greg and Ernie were kind enough to send along a demo kit to me. So I've got basically two of every size saddle and a handful of Predator platforms and pretty much everything that they have and sell, I've got available here to use as demos. So I'm always getting messages from guys that want to come try it before they buy it. You know, hey, I heard you've got this stuff. Can I come try it? So I put on saddle demos, and then, you know, for crowds, big groups, as well as for individuals, you know. So it's not uncommon for me to have, you know, one, two, three guys show up and just do that on a, you know, regular weekday evening and set up in my yard here. I'm tucked back in the woods, so I've got plenty of trees to climb and lots of different climbing methods to test out. And saddles to try on and get you fitted for the size that you need. And that way you can see if it's for you, for one. But then if it is, what size do you need? That's always a big question. You know, so those resources are available. And there's also a Saddle Hunter Google map. If you get onto the Saddle Hunter website, saddlehunter.com, there's a map that's attached to that that you can actually, it's got a filter on it to find other saddle hunters in your area. So, you know, if you're not in Michigan, you know, not wanting to take a drive to, you know, find a guy like myself, there's probably somebody in your area that's got some stuff. And usually almost everybody that I've seen that's put their information on that map is doing it because they're, you know, all about building the saddle hunting community. So usually you'll find somebody on there that is relatively close to you that you can meet up with and either, you know, try their gear out or, you know, climbing methods, saddles, whatever. There's a good community out there. That's kind of one of the cool things about kind of the organic nature of our community. It's really been like a family, so there's a lot of great people to connect with. Good resources.
For sure, man. And we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. I think that's kind of all we got tonight. Like I said, getting into the season and, you know, with a lot of guys, you know, kind of maybe falling into the same old, we're going to start talking a little bit more about tactics and about thought processes. And, you know, both of those hunts that you outlined there kind of, you know, get to dive down into the actual process that it goes into to be consistently successful, and to try to maybe break down these areas and you know, to the little outside of the box thinking. So, you know, we really appreciate you coming on here and taking the time to chat with us this evening.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, no problem. We'll have to
always a good time
get together and get Frank up in one of them saddles and see what size fits him.
Yeah, the 67-year-old fat man, you know.
Hey, I've got just the thing for you.
I'll bet you do.
All right. Well, we look forward to talking to you again. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yep. Later.